So, honest question, how many of you are tired this morning? A few of you? How many of you are like really tired this morning? Like exhausted, tired, a few of you? Appreciate your honesty. I'll tell you, the bad news is you might feel the same way next week because you lose an hour of sleep, but there you go. There's your reminder. But we know that feeling, right? Where you're like so tired you can hardly function. Maybe you can hardly even like finish a thought. That's a feeling that I'm more aware than I'd like to be of, more familiar of. But this is the situation we come into in Mark chapter 5. We have some individuals who are absolutely exhausted. You've maybe been to that point where all you can think about is when you get to lay down and go to sleep because you're so tired. Anyone with me? You've been there? A few of you? This week? Anyone? Right now? Anyone? Okay. Well, Mark chapter 5, if you want to turn there, this is where the story begins. Hopefully it's going to be there. There's where the story begins. This is on a boat in the Sea of Galilee. And if you were with us last week, you may remember the story of the storm in the night. The storm that whipped up and was threatening to sink the boats that the disciples and Jesus were in as Jesus was sleeping. There they were on the Sea of Galilee. It looked much different than this. Waves swamping this 20-something foot boat. And maybe you remember, if you were here last week, that the interesting thing about that story was after Jesus commanded the wind and waves to be still, and they were, it seems the disciples were more frightened at that point than they had been during the storm, because suddenly they were faced with these questions of who is this Jesus that has this authority to do these things and to calm this storm? Also, if you were with us, you'll remember that that all happened at the tail end of a really long day. They had gotten in the boat probably to get away and get rest because they had spent the entire day with Jesus teaching from a boat out in the sun, managing these giant crowds. I'm starting to feel this is like tiring to think about the reality of what the disciples are dealing with, that they all day are doing crowd management. They're wrestling, if you'll remember from a couple weeks ago in the parables, as Joshua was here teaching, the disciples themselves are wrestling to try to understand what Jesus was teaching, and they're dealing with everything that needs to be done, and they're out in the sun all day, and then they finally get on the boat to get away and get some rest, and the storm happens, and I imagine they didn't sleep that night at all, even after the storm. They've got to be wiped out. They've got to be wiped out. And so we come to Mark chapter 5, and this first verse, I just have this picture. You know, we read, they came to the other side of the sea. This is the Sea of Galilee, also called the Lake of Gennesaret, to the country of the Gerasenes. As they come ashore, this is kind of what the area looks like to give you a sense of the Sea of Galilee. This is a bit of a map. Where they started was up here on Capernaum, and now we're here in what's now Kersey, down in this region of the Gerasenes, where these hills are. And I can just imagine, by the way, this is what it looks like. It's rather beautiful. That's from the hillside looking out on the lake there. And so they're pulling up to this beautiful place, and as they approach land and they're getting ready to tie up their boats, I'm sure the disciples' minds are on rest, but also getting away from the water after what they've just experienced, just going to recharge. And, for these guys, many of them who are professional fishermen, probably they've never been so excited to just get their feet on the dirt and get off that boat and get away from everything just that happened, get some space, try to process, see what's going on. But as they approach shore, there's this very strange figure coming towards them. Actually frightening. And he's running. Charlie just read this for us, but I just want you to imagine this scene, if you will, this morning. This is in verse 2. Just pulling up to shore after all this, and this is what you come upon. It says, when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. Already kind of weird. It gets weirder. Verse 3. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. So this is not a small person, right? Verse 5. Night and day among the tombs and in the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. So it's like, welcome to shore, guys, right? You thought it was over. And this is what you get. Now, Mark makes it pretty clear in the original Greek that this is like an immediate encounter as they arrive. In fact, a few translations try to capture this by translating verse 2, saying things like, as Jesus got out of the boat, or immediately. So probably this person is running towards the boat even before they're tied up and ready to get out, and running out to meet Jesus. And here he comes and falls at his knees. And this, again, isn't an ordinary person. He's controlled by unclean spirits. He's clearly strong and imposing. People have attempted to bind him with chains, which begs the question, why did they feel the need to bind him with chains? Was he dangerous? Was he causing trouble? But apparently he was even breaking free from these chains and tearing them apart both on his hands and his ankles. Mark's pretty specific. In fact, perhaps as he's running to Jesus, there's still a shackle or a bit of chain hanging off one of his wrists or his ankles. And he's been living in caves, and not just in caves, but caves that are used for burial. In the Jewish sense, this meant he was unclean and they should stay away from him. And here he is running up to Jesus. Also means he's kind of creepy, hanging out, you know, in burial caves. Mark tells us that day and night he was crying out and he was cutting himself with stones. If you can imagine the torment this individual is feeling. An interesting detail, because as you look around what is known today as Kersey, the area where the story takes place, if you look on the ground everywhere, all the stones are round. And I remember going and traveling there and thinking, well, how does this story make any sense? Because all the rocks are round everywhere. You don't cut yourself with round rocks. We'll get back to that in a second. But picture the fear on the disciples' faces, because I'm sure it's very real, legitimate fear. And they've already had so much to deal with, right? The last night was nothing but fear. They're hoping for a reprieve from that. And all of a sudden, this is what they're encountering, is this individual. He's running. He's screaming. Perhaps Peter's already grabbing the oar or a knife to, like, you know, fend him off. Don't know how they're reacting. Guy's out of his mind. He's got scars all over him, remnants of being bound. Certainly wasn't well kept. He was dirty, probably crazy hair, and oh, by the way, it seems he was naked. Like, uncomfortable a little for anyone? This guy comes running at you, what are you going to do, right? Probably pick up the oar or start paddling out or something. I'm imagining these disciples probably want to get right back in the boat all of a sudden and start, you know, rowing in the other direction. But we've already seen Jesus caring for unexpected people, right? If you've been paying attention, he's been seeking out and caring for people who are outcasts, people like tax collectors, those in great need. These crowds that have developed around him are largely people who are broken, who need healing, or have brought people who need healing. And now Jesus is going to love a man who's downright dangerous, who's controlled by a host of demons. And this is kind of a fascinating story. In fact, if we're honest, this story takes some faith to believe, because it's a pretty incredible story with the pigs and the guy and all this stuff going on. So Jesus talks to the demons controlling this man. That's fairly interesting in itself, right? And then what happens? Notice in verse 11. If you can just try to picture this. This is crazy. This isn't just like pigs on a flannel graph in Sunday school. Like, this is a story that Mark is giving us as history, and this is crazy. It says there's a great herd of pigs that were feeding on the hillside, and these demons begged Jesus, saying, send us to the pigs, let us enter them. And so he gave them permission. If you can imagine this, these unclean spirits come out, they enter the pigs, and all of a sudden this herd of 2,000 pigs rushes down the steep bank into the sea, and they're drowned. Can you picture the cloud of dust? Like, this is a really weird, uncomfortable story, right? Very strange. How many think the disciples are wide awake at this point? Some newfound energy called adrenaline and fear and confusion, right? I'd suggest, again, that there's no question they have got to be terrified. They're terrified of Jesus from the night before. They're hearing these sounds of first this insane demon-possessed guy, and then all of a sudden these pigs, and this is intense. This is strange. Dust is kicking up. These pigs are racing off. I don't know what it sounds like when pigs drown. That's kind of a disturbing thought. And not to mention, now we have these people who are tending the pigs, who see this all happen, who run off to tell everybody else. So now we're probably going to get in trouble, because those 2,000 pigs cost a lot, and somebody's not going to be happy, right? This is all like just unfolding in front of them in real time. And the most amazing thing is now this man who is out of control, who's injuring himself, who everyone's terrified of and avoiding, who's been living in burial caves in a craze. In verse 15, Mark tells us that he's sitting with Jesus, dressed and in his right mind. Can you just try to enter this story for a minute and imagine what that's like for the disciples? Like, how crazy is this experience? And suddenly you're sitting with this person who's kind of really terrifying, but now they're seeming normal. And yeah, they also now have clothes on. So did they provide him clothes? We don't know some of those details, but it's a fascinating story. Mark doesn't tell us about the moments between when this guy gains his freedom and when the crowd shows up. I wonder if he was embarrassed. I wonder if he was apologetic or just plain out excited. Wonder if, you know, is it awkward, like trying to strike up conversation between the disciples and this guy, like, you know, a middle school boy and girl who like each other, trying to figure out how to talk. Like, was it just awkward? Because all this is part of this story, right? It's there. We don't get all the details, but there's this incredible situation. I wonder if this man's looking at the cuts on his arms and on his body and just sadness and disbelief of what's become of me, what's going on. What we do know is that in an instant, this man's life is restored. And Jesus gives freedom to somebody that probably wasn't valued by other people. And we'll see in a couple verses, he also gives him this new purpose. The reality of this man who must have been notorious and watched out for to be avoided, now sitting normally, along with the reality of those missing pigs, causes all the people of the area to have a actually kind of rational response. They beg Jesus to leave because this is really scary when this stuff starts happening in your town, right? Like if we had somebody show up and a bunch of pigs died off and crazy things were happening, we might be a little uncomfortable with that, right? That's their response. They beg Jesus to leave. They're scared. They're freaked out. Again, can you feel a little bit for these disciples at this point? Like they just got out of the boat. They just went through that night. All this happens, and now what are they going to have to do? Get back into the boat. I wonder if they're wondering what's going to happen when they get back out on the water. Is it going to be like Storm 2.0? Like what's coming next, right? This is their situation. Give you just a little more sense of the story. This is, again, looking down on Kersey. This is actually from within a cave up on the hillside. There's, like the story talks about, there's caves all along there, and some of them were used for burial tombs. If you look really closely, by the way, you notice, again, even on the edge of this cave, those are mostly like round rocks, like a river rock kind of stuck in there. And these are the kind of spaces, likely, that this guy was residing in. These, again, are caves right on the hillside there in Kersey. If you want to hear about it sometime, I'll tell you the story about running through an area that said don't enter because of landmines and meeting a viper in one of these caves. It was pretty awesome. But this is an incredible story, and I think when we come across these incredible stories as people given rational capacities, it's worth asking some questions. It's worth noting the details. It's interesting that Mark chooses to give us this really specific detail of the caves, of, you know, the things he doesn't give us. He gives us some specific details, and one of them is that this man is cutting himself with stones. And one of the really interesting things that moved me when I visited is you go up in these caves, and what you discover is on the floor of these caves are, in fact, sharp rocks. Sharp rocks. Chert, is that what it's called? Is it flint? Because I thought that's what it was. Which is interesting, because how would Mark have known to manufacture that detail in the story? And this is actually from one of those caves I was in with that picture. And it is, you kind of feel what a sharp rock is like, and you start to imagine somebody sitting there and, you know, injuring themselves with things like this. You just start to feel like the grit and the pain and the difficulty of the story. But how fascinating, right? That the details we get that seem like they don't make sense, you go up there and they actually kind of corroborate themselves. If you want to see it later and it helps you kind of understand the story, this is a rock from one of those caves. So we have this man who's avoided and feared, who's a spectacle, who's an embarrassment, who's cutting himself with rocks. And then Jesus comes along, and we have this wild story that ensues. We go from this man laying in the dirt in this crazed agony, cutting and screaming night and day, to being dressed and clean and in his right mind. What's amazing about this story, I find, as if we need more to be amazed at, because it's an incredible story, is up until this point, if you've been paying attention in Mark, it's been really clear that every time Jesus interacts with demons or unclean spirits and people, he tells them to shut up, essentially. Don't say anything about who I am. He forces them to be quiet. When people come to Jesus and they're healed, like the leper earlier in Mark, Jesus is very specific and says, don't go tell anybody. Be quiet about this. It isn't yet to be public, and he's keeping people from sharing the news about who he is. Of course, they go and say some things anyways, and so crowds start showing up, and it becomes difficult. But he continually is warning people not to speak openly about who he is. But in Mark, it's this crazy, demon-possessed man covered in scars of his own making that essentially gets commissioned and sent out as the first witness and missionary of Jesus. Notice the ending again to the story. This is, I believe, in verse 18. As he was getting into the boat, this is Jesus, the man who had been possessed with demons, begged him that he might be with him. He wanted to go along for the ride. He might have been the only one that wanted to get in the boat with Jesus after what the disciples had gone through. In verse 19, this is what we read, and he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that's these 10 kind of free cities in the Roman world, probably where he was from, how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Now, one of the elements of this story, that, again, that I think many of us need to hear, certainly I do, is there's no such thing as a life too far gone and too messed up for God not only to restore, but to give purpose to. I find it compelling that this is the first person sent out, because he's like arguably the biggest mess we come across in the Gospels. Like, this guy is scary. If you think you don't have much to offer or you've made a mess in your life, so God must not have much value for you, you know, you might consider this stone, you might consider the spectacle that was this guy, the mess physically, emotionally, spiritually that was this human being who was not even able to be in society and just a wreck. Man, again, avoided and feared, out of control. And Jesus not only saw him worthy to be restored, but further, he chooses this man to go out and be his witness and to tell the world of Jesus. So if you think for a moment that there's something about your life that's too much for God to want to use you, to work through you, to give purpose, to restore you. You might just ask, are you crazy? Do you break chains? Do you live in caves? Do you run around naked screaming? Hopefully the answer is no to those, by the way. The point is that you're probably not as bad off as this guy was. Anyone would have looked at him and said, he has nothing to offer the world. Nothing. In fact, he's a liability and we should all get away from him. That's exactly what was happening. He's possessed by a legion of demons. And so I would argue to us this morning that if Jesus sees value and has compassion and love and can give purpose to a person like this, why for an instant would we think that Jesus couldn't do the same for us? That's part of the compelling nature of this story. Is if you think you're bad, like, this dude can one-up you a few times. And if Jesus would love a person like this, what would cause us to think there's a big enough reason in our lives that he wouldn't love us? If Jesus would send this man out to be one of his first commissioned witnesses, why would we think he wouldn't do the same with us, with you and with me? I think of the words of Paul as he's writing to the church in Corinth, a church that was rather confused, thinking that, you know, their usefulness was dependent on their stature or pedigree or their talents. Maybe you know this. This is from towards the end of 1 Corinthians 1. Paul begins by telling them, essentially, you aren't of noble birth. You aren't any big deal at all, like you think you are. In verse 27, he says this. He says, but God chose what's foolish in the world to shame the wise. And God chose what's weak in the world to shame the strong. And God chose what's low, what's despised in the world. I hear that word despised. I think of this guy. I don't think that's too strong of a term. Even things that are not, to bring it to nothing, things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. This story to me is a reminder that sometimes we get it upside down, don't we? We think it's about what we have to offer, what we've accomplished, what we bring to the table. And yet what we find in this story is somebody that absolutely brings nothing but liability and problems and difficulty. And yet God sends him out as a witness to who Jesus is. Like this man in Mark 5, in all of our own failings and imperfections, we're offered new life in Christ. And what's more, it's the foolish, the lowly, the overlooked, the undervalued, even despised, people on the outside who don't seem to have much to offer, that again and again and again, consistently through the New Testament, these are the people God chooses to work through. Hopefully that's some good news for you this morning. I know it is for me. I think we also need to hear this story through the lens or the view, the experience of the disciples, because the reality is they almost certainly didn't see the value in this man that Jesus did. They almost certainly saw him as an obstacle to the rest that they really wanted. I mean, because of him, they end up going back on the boat, out on the water again, right? And we'll continue to see as we study through Mark together that one of the themes that keeps emerging, part of the journey of following Jesus, is that these disciples are in process of learning to see people the way Jesus sees them. Whether it's kids coming up that they're saying, don't bother Jesus, or it's somebody who's in desperate need of help who's crying out for Jesus and they're saying, be quiet. Through the Gospel of Mark, we continue to see that the disciples themselves, those closest to Jesus, those under his teaching, are struggling to be able to see people the way Jesus sees them. Perhaps from this story, we need to hear this gentle call or reminder that in a similar sense, we need to continue to lean in, continue to grow in our ability to value people who seem unlovable, maybe even crazy or dirty, scary. Maybe you work with people like that, I don't know. But likely you encounter them somewhere in your life, and people that we have a tendency to want to just write off or devalue or give up on. And maybe we need to hear Jesus speaking with and loving this man. I mean, you talk about an awkward, difficult story. This guy, again, is probably unclothed and disgusting at the feet of Jesus. And his response is to love him, to care for him. Even in that state, he gets clothed. Obviously, the demons get driven out. But as we encounter people in our lives this week who are difficult, can we picture how Jesus is responding? How he would love them the way he loved this man? That we might have our sort of lenses adjusted to the way he sees. We're going to continue singing a couple more songs this morning. And as we do, I'd love for you to do something with me and just pull out your bulletin. The last question on the back is a very open-ended question. It's simply this: what do you need to hear from this story today? I want to invite you as we sing to just in prayer ask that question. God, what do I need to hear from this story? What do I need to be reminded of, to learn, to understand in a new way today? And as we sing, let's just collectively pray that prayer and trust that God is going to speak and lead. Give us ears to hear and hearts to respond to the action that God would be inviting us to. And if something does clearly come to mind, I'd encourage you to just write it down so you don't forget and keep that in front of you this week. Let's pray. Father, thank you for a strange story. Thank you for little details like sharp rocks. Thank you most of all that what we see in this story his incredible compassion and an incredible ability to see value in someone no one else sees, and love to engage and to restore and even to send out. Father, as we consider our own relationship with you, if the lens needs to be adjusted that we would see more clearly the way you love us, would you speak this morning and give us ears to hear it? And Father, as we consider our relationships with other people this morning, and we just recognize we're still in process of learning to see people the way you see them. Well, if there's someone in particular that you would just be nudging us to love in a new way or have newfound compassion for, patience for, would you give us ears to hear that? That we could respond to the goodness of who Christ is, both by receiving your love, but also by giving love that images you. We pray this in Jesus' name.